Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Pranaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavati Tamastu Mavit Gushavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Dashamasmiti Vakyutta Dashamasmiti Vakyutta Nadirasya Vihanyate Nadirasya Vihanyate Adimadhyavasaneshu Adimadhyavasaneshu Nanavatvasya Samshayaha Nanavatvasya Samshayaha. It's verse 60. Dashamaha asmi iti vakya utta dihi asya vihanyate adi madhya avasaneshu na navatvasya samshayaha. If you remember with verse 59, it says, when the question, who is the tenth man, was answered as you are, it's just literally, and the question was, who is the tenth man, was asked, it was and was answered, when it was answered, you are the tenth man, then the tenth man, having counted all of the other nine, including himself, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, having counted all of them, he realized himself, ah, I'm the tenth man, right? Became very clear. So, but after having done that, right, after having done that count. Okay, so now it says, Dashamaha asmi iti, I am the tenth. I am the tenth man. Dashamaha asmi iti. Vakya utta. Di na dihi asya vihanyate. The dihi means the thought, the vritti, the knowledge, right? What knowledge? The knowledge that arises, utta, vakya utta. The knowledge that arises from the statement, vakya utta. So the dihi, which arises, utta, from the vakya, from the statement, dashamaha asmi, I am the tenth man, right? There's a knowledge that comes of that buddhi that comes, asya for him. That buddhi means that knowledge, na vihanyate. That knowledge can't be destroyed. Na vihanyate. It can't be rejected, it can't be destroyed. He says, Adi Madhya Avasaneshu. He says, in the beginning, middle, or end. I'll explain that in the middle. Adi means beginning, Madhya means in the middle, Avasana means in the end. Na Navatvasya Samshayaha. There is now Na Samshayaha. There's no doubt at all about being nine, about Navatva, the state of there being only nine. Now there's no such doubt at all. And there's no doubt in reference to the beginning, before the inquiry, in the middle of the inquiry, avasana at the end of the inquiry. In other words, that when the tenth man recognizes, I'm the tenth man, there's no such doubt that I'm the tenth man, but there used to be only nine. In the beginning, there were only nine, but the tenth man has come. Or in the middle of the inquiry, the tenth man has appeared. Or at the end of the inquiry, the tenth man is discovered. There's no such there's no possibility of any such doubt once the person recognizes, I am the tenth man, right? And so what we'll see in the next verse, but what we're getting to here, what does aparoksha jnana mean? What does it mean, first of all, to have jnana nishta? Everybody hears this term, jnana nishta. It means a jnani, somebody who has self-knowledge, who's who is mature in their knowledge. They say that person has jnana nishtha. Their knowledge is firm, it is rooted, right? They know themselves without any doubt. Well, what would that be like to have jnana nishtha? Well, it's like the tenth man recognizing, I am the tenth man. Now, in the previous verse, they talked about the vichara that is necessary, the analysis that's necessary to have that nishtha, I am the tenth man. The tenth man had to count all of the other nine so that, in fact, there was no other possibility. Right? You see how that is? Counting when the story, to understand really the strength of this story, the counting off of the other nine is critical. Right? Because if you count those other nine, and then somebody says, points to you, what are you going to do? You know? So there's a direct, immediate recognition that takes place at that time, which you can't do anything about. Nothing can come and shake it and say, oh, you're not really the tenth man. Because all of the other possibilities have been negated, and you already are aparoksha. Right? Your being is already self-evident. Right? But so once it's pointed out, that which is already self-evident experientially becomes self-evident to the buddhi, right? To the mind. It becomes self-evident to the mind. And there's nothing that, there's no other types of thoughts or objections that now can come up. Say, well, maybe I'm not the tenth man. But that's the doubt. Those are the doubts. No, it could be, this could have happened. It could be like this, you know? So these doubts, every single possibility has to be negated to the satisfaction of the buddhi. That's why the story is so profound in its simplicity, because you can see that when it comes to being number 10, if he counts those nine, all of the possible doubts have been eliminated. You see that? So he has to be that. And he already is that. The tenth man already is the tenth man. And so there's just a veil of ignorance between the tenth man and the tenth man. Now, it's important here to understand something. When we say these words like avarna and vikshepa, you know, avarna, there's ajnana, there's ignorance of the tenth man, and then there's a covering. People take this word covering as though there's some sort of a covering, you know, like the veil of ignorance. It's like between my mind and myself, there's a veil. And I have to pull the veil. But there is no veil. There is no veil of ignorance. Just think about it. There's no physical veil of any sort that stops the tenth man experience from being the tenth man experience. See what I'm saying? The tenth man is the tenth man. When the tenth man is told, you are the tenth man, what is the change in the tenth man experience? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. The tenth man is the tenth man, but the tenth man didn't realize I am the tenth man. And so in not realizing that, there's a lot of repercussions. Because even though I am the tenth man and the experience stays exactly the same, whether I say I am not the tenth man or I am the tenth man, like there's no change in the experience. But that ignorance that the experience of the tenth man is the tenth man, that ignorance causes a lot of samsara for the mind. Because look at what happens to the mind. The mind's all worried now. After all, as the tenth man story, it's supposed to be the leader, right? The tenth man is the leader of all of his little his troop that he's taken across the river. Now one of them is dead, probably. It looks like it died in the river. Well, that's a tragedy. Right? So now one has died in the river. This guy's life is over because he was so irresponsible, he killed him. It goes on and on and on and on and on. So Goswamiji tells the story. He has the tenth man go over to a tree and start banging his head on the tree, weeping. What to do about the tenth man who's, and the family of the tenth man. They're going to be so heartbroken. How can he face them? And I can't even remember his name. Swamiji, honest to God. Yes, I know. So, do you see? The aparokshatvam of the reality, the actual being of the tenth man. Aparokshat means the self-evident being, experiential being, the self-evident person is there. But the mind doesn't recognize that that self-evident person is the tenth man. And so the knowledge, counting out the other nine, pointing, you are the tenth man, is necessary for the mind of that person to recognize, oh, I'm the tenth man. You see, nothing has happened. There is no new experience. But there is a recognition of what this experience is. This is our situation here. You are the tenth man. You are Brahman. When you say, I am, I exist, I am a conscious being, those words, those are just words. Like if I say, this is a lamp, this is a table. If I say, I am a conscious being, these are just words taking place in the mind. But words point to something. Words mean something, right? They're pointing to something. And so now, if you say, I am a conscious being, those words are pointing, labeling the conscious being that you are. That is the me, the self. But the ignorance has nothing to do with the self experience. It has to do with the adhyasa, the superimposition, that causes you to say, I am a conscious being because of this body. Right? Or, I am the conscious being. I, this body, am the conscious being. I, this body-mind, am the conscious being. I, this soul that is inhabiting the body-mind, am this conscious being. That's where the ignorance is. It's not in the conscious being, which is self-evident. See what I'm saying? That's why when you gain self-knowledge, the self-evident me doesn't change at all. The self-evident me is the me that I always have been. There's no waver there. But what does change is the superimposition of my me, of this person, the me that I am, the superimposition of my own presence on the body, which is an object of knowledge through sense perception, or the mind, which is an object of knowledge through, just through the sakshi being illumined, the mind thoughts come and go, and they're sattva. You know, sattva, rajas, and tamas, they're sattva, they reflect consciousness. And so these thoughts that come and go and come and go and come and go and come and go, emotions come and go and come and go and come and go, I say, I am that. That's the ajnanam. It's taking me to be that. There's nothing, there's no ajnanam. There's no ignorance around the meanness of me. Because that's a paroksha. It's the same for everybody. Everybody says, I am, I am, I am, I am, I am. They're all referring to Brahman. They're always referring to the self that you are. But you don't realize that this me that I am is the me of all beings. That this me that I am is the me of Ishvara. Is the very me, the very self of the creation. That's what I don't know. The me I know completely. In terms experientially, is the self-evident nature that I take to be myself right now. So the only thing that's missing here is that the ignorance is causing is the superimposition, taking myself, adding all of these things onto me. That is the big problem. So why is this important? Because when you gain knowledge, when the Upanishad, when the teaching methodology is, the pramana is being given to you, when it's being unfolded, you're not looking to have an experience. How can you have another experience of yourself? Yourself is already here. So it's recognizing that, oh, this me is Brahman. that when you talk about Brahman, you're talking about this me that I am. That isn't a new experience. But it's a straightening out of the medley of experiences that you're having at any given moment. In this medley of experiences, by what I mean by that is you're having sensory experiences through all the five sense organs, you know, whereas physical experiences, emotional experiences, you know, thought flow, perceptions, all kinds of experiences are taking place. But the one who feels those experiences, who is the very self of those experiences, is constant. But that self gets continually superimposed on these experiences that are coming and going. That's what has to be straightened out. That's where the ignorance lies. Now say, just like with the tenth man, when the tenth man has, even though is the tenth man, thinks the tenth man is lost. Right? It causes a lot of problems for the mind. Just look at your situation. Even though you're being, you are the self of the creation. You're the limitless, changeless self of the whole creation. You're the self of Ishvara. And changeless Satchit Ananda. That's your being. That's who you are. But the mind, enjoying me, my presence, who is the most beloved to the mind, because you don't want to die. You know, you always want your everything that you do, in fact, is a pranam to your being. You know, let me be happy. Let me be whole. Let me be complete. You want the mind just to get out of the way so you can, you know, shine as you are. You know? So when that isn't recognized, or that is superimposed upon things that are finite, then that means that you are in a very, very precarious situation. You're subject to death. And if you're ananda, all you know about the ananda is bliss states of the mind, like through satisfying desire, that's the best you can do. And you see bliss states, happiness, coming and going, happy, happy, sad, happy, sad, happy, sad. Actually, Swamiji goes like this. Happy, sad, 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 sad. Happy, sad, 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 sad. You know? So, the mind is upset because things aren't as they're supposed to be. And it's correct. Things aren't as they're supposed to be. Because, in fact, you're not happy, sad, 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 sad. You're ananda. And you're not subject to birth and death. You're timeless. You know? You're not subject to ignorance. You're the very being, the very knowledge that illumines all ignorance. Now that's also really, really important recognition, because when you get to the very being of you, of who you are, you're the one that illumines knowledge. I know this, I know this, I know this, I know this. Whatever the vritti is, whatever the thought modification is, it is known. Right? So you're the knowledge that illumines the vritti. What about something that's not known? Well, I illumine that too. What do I illumine? Ah, this. No, I don't know that. Right? So I illumine what I know and I illumine what I don't know. That means knowledge and ignorance, really, in terms of vrittis or perceptions, take place in knowledge. I am the knowledge. Awareness, consciousness itself is the knowledge, which all vrittis enjoy, because every vritti is known, right? It is known, it is known, it is known, it is known. But the knowledge that allows it to be known is awareness. That's what gives you the sense of something being known. It's the very nature of consciousness itself. And so when we say Satchit Ananda, I am the very being which is consciousness, which Swamiji will often talk when he's doing the unfoldment of Satchit Ananda, he'll talk about consciousness as pure knowledge. The pure knowledge, the known, you know, the knownness which is there enjoyed by every vritti, every thought modification. You should think of it like this. And this, I know this is sometimes confusing when I do this for people, but nevertheless I keep trying it. Every thought that comes, every experience that you have is known. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what it is. If it's a vritti, it's a thought modification, that thought modification is known. Right? It is, and it is known. That means everything in the vritti is and is known. What I'm saying is that if you get rid of the vritti, just hypothetically, what is left is and is known. That's the sat-chit. The sat-chit is the isness and knownness, which the whole creation enjoys. You never have an experience away from sat-chit. The isness and knownness is the very center of all experience, and you can't have an experience without it. It is the common denominator. What we tend to not understand is that sat-chit, that is the ananda. It's not that just as the sat is unwavering, right? It's not a little bit of sat over here, or let's have a little bigger dose of sat. You don't think like that. Let's have a bigger dose of existence. Let's have a more profound experience of existence. We don't think that way. Existence is existence. Being is being. If I say, think of your own being, your own presence, that's good. Yeah, my being, my presence, fine. And that, if I say that being, that presence, is consciousness. Yes, I'm not going to say it's inert. If I say it's self-evident consciousness, yes. What if I say, why don't you make it a little more conscious? Why don't you just, you know, do something to make the consciousness
expand?
Well, yes, we can make it expand, we can make it, but I want to change the quality of the consciousness. Tweak it. Tweak the consciousness. We don't tend to think like that. We tend to accept sat and chit, the existent conscious being. But it's when we bring in this word ananda that then we want an experience. I am sat and chit. Just give me the experience of ananda to be enlightened, you know. I'm sat, chit, but where's the darned ananda? So, that the reason for that is the mistranslation of ananda as bliss, because when you say bliss, right, if you read all of these books, they'll translate ananda as bliss. If you say bliss, well, I'm not in bliss right now. How many bliss experiences have you had? And it has to be the ultimate bliss experience too, right? So the word itself, because of its conditioning, first of all, the mistranslation. It is, in a sense, a mistranslation, but that word can be used as bliss just in Vyavahara, I mean, just in empirical reality. So it's not exactly a mistranslation, but it's a mistranslation in this context. And so now, what needs to be understood is that just as I can identify the nature of consciousness and of being, now I have to recognize, what is this conscious being? What is its nature? Its nature is consciousness. Its nature is existence. Its nature is fullness. Why do I say fullness? Or I could say its nature is consciousness. Its nature is existence. Its nature is the beloved. Why do I say that? Well, because there is nothing more meaningful to me, nothing more beloved than me, nothing more stable, whole, complete than the very being that I am right now here. You don't need and you won't get another experience of it. You know, it's not like the tenth man discovers I am the tenth man and all of a sudden his being becomes blissful. His mind might be really happy, you know, for the moment, and he'll get over it and everything's fine. He'll forget all about it. And it's just a thought modification. It's a happy thought modification. His recognition of I am the tenth man doesn't have to do with a bliss experience. See what I'm saying? That your recognition of your being, the ananda, is already here, is what I'm trying to say. It's already here. So you have to recognize what about me is so, so beloved and present, not as an experience to be gained, but as something to be recognized. So that's the whole Satchitananda. So when he's saying here, we're talking, let's go back to the verse. We're talking about the non-negatable fact of aparoksha jnanam and jnana nishtha. Person who has aparoksha jnanam, aparoksha means direct, immediate knowledge. The jnani, the one who has self-knowledge, has to have aparoksha jnanam of myself. That means it's direct, immediate recognition of the one who is here amidst all of the experience that I'm having. Right? I am here along with all of this experience. I have to recognize myself amidst all of my experience and then recognize the nature of all of this experience that I'm having in reference to myself. To do that, I have to have an unfoldment, right? So that I can say, I am Brahman. I have an unfoldment that allows me to say that I am Brahman. But to be able to say it, like the tenth man can say, I am the tenth man, I have to have negated every doubt that I have that says, I am not Brahman. Every doubt. Like the tenth man theoretically can't just count off six and then say, I'm the tenth. He has to count off the nine and then say, I'm the tenth. And like that, we have to count off every doubt that the mind has that would allow us to say, well, I'm not sure if I'm Brahman. I'm not sure if I'm Brahman because of this and because of this and because of that. And so that has to be taken care of. But when that is taken care of, that aparoksha jnanam is there and it can't be negated because I am that. Right? It's not a paroksha jnanam. It's not a knowledge of stepping away from myself. It's a knowledge of my very being. And so that knowledge of my being, once it's recognized, becomes non-negatable. So let's see how they work with this a little bit more.
Sadevetyadivakena Brahmasattvam parokshatah, Brahmasattvam parokshatah, Grahitvatattvamasyadi, Vakyat vyaktim samulikhet, Vakyat vyaktim samulikhet. Sat, eva, iti, adi, vakyena, Brahma sattvam parokshatah grahitva tat tvam asi adi vakyat vyaktim samulikhet. Okay.
So using this tenth man story is going to do a lot of what I've already done, but let's see it. By the vakya sat eva iti. There's a vakya that begins with sat. Sat alone. I'll tell you the vakya in a minute. By the vakya, vakyena, adi vakyena, by the vakya which begins with sat alone, the brahmasattvam, the existence, the truth of Brahman, the being of Brahman, the truth of Brahman, the brahmasattvam, parokshitaha, grahitva, having grasped, having understood indirectly, right, from paroksha jnana, the existence of Brahman, the nature of Brahman, from the vakya, beginning with sadeva, having understood it, then tat tvamasi adi vakyat, from the vakya, you are that, tat tvamasi vakya, from the vakya, you are that, vyaktim samulikhet. He recognizes, from that vakya, he recognizes directly, clearly, the very nature of Brahman, the vyakti. Vyakti means, say if I say there is such a thing as Brahman, and Brahman is like that. You have a general now, I'm describing it to you, I'm unfolding it to you, and you have a general knowledge of Brahman. It's like an indirect knowledge. Brahman is like this, right? But you don't know Brahman. Even though you are Brahman, you still don't know Brahman. But Brahman is being described to you, how Brahman is. But then, when the analysis takes place, you realize that this Brahman, who is the one, who is the existence from which all beings have come, this general painting the picture of who Brahman is, once the analysis begins, takes place, you recognize that this Brahman that's being unfolded by the Upanishads is yourself. You recognize that through the teaching methodology that takes the Brahman, which has been described, takes it through vichara, through analysis, to the recognition that this Brahman that's being described is in fact me. Tetramasi, that thou art. So here's the verse that he's quoting. I have it here in my Bhasha. It's a very famous verse. The verse goes like this. When Shvetaketu, this is the kind of the stories in Chandogya, chapter 6, the Chandogya Upanishad. Shvetaketu was sent by his father, Aruni, to study. When he was 12 years old, I think, he was sent to a Gurukula to study with a teacher to learn all of the Vedas and everything that he was supposed to learn as a Brahmin born. He went there, he stayed for 12 years, and came back all well-educated and arrogant. Okay. As it says in the Upanishad, full of himself. He came back so well-educated and full of himself. So his father asked him in so many words, well, you've been studying there for a long time. Did you ask your teacher, what is that knowing which everything is as well known? Did you ask your teacher that? And Shvetaketu said, well, no, he didn't tell me that. He didn't tell me. Did you ask? No. No, I didn't ask. And so then he asked his father to teach him. And the very famous conversation, dialogue, the very famous, the Tetramasi teaching unfolds from this. A famous teaching. We should do it sometime. But this is how Aruni, Shvetaketu's father, begins teaching him. He says, Sad Eva Saumya. Saumya is a very kind of, oh dear boy, my dear son, you know, hey Saumya, he goes. Sadeva idam agre asit. Sat alone, sat eva, sat alone, existence alone, in the beginning, asit. In the beginning, there was only existence, only being, sadeva. Sat eva idam agre asit. He says, idam, he goes like this. Idam, this, in the beginning, was existence alone. So when you say idam, you mean this creation, this. In the beginning, this was existence alone. What kind of existence? Ekam eva advitiyam. Existence which was one alone. Ekam means one. One alone, without a second. Advitiyam. One. In the beginning, this was one non-dual existence alone. That's how he starts. And then he goes on to say something like, some will say in the beginning there was non-existence. And then there's an argument on how it's impossible for existence to come from non-existence. But he starts with this. In the beginning there was existence alone. And then, having started with that, he... And explaining all of that, because just think how this is how for Shvetaketu this vision is being unfolded. His father starts by teaching him what the Upanishads say is Brahman, right? In the beginning, this was only Sat, and goes on in unfolding more and more and more in terms of the nature of Brahman, the one from whom all beings have come, you know, who sustains all beings, the ones into whom all beings go. So there's a whole unfoldment that takes place. But then he has, after having made Shwetaketu realize that all of this is nothing but Brahman. That's basically the first part of it. What Shwetaketu understands, all of this is nothing but Brahman. This is Brahman alone. Everything, in the beginning there was only Brahman. In the beginning there was only one non-dual existence. And from that one non-dual existence, all of this has come. And into that one non-dual existence, all of this is, by that it is sustained. And into this one non-dual existence, all of this goes, will return. Okay. And then he takes Shwetaketu step by step by step to recognizing that this physical world, right, resolves into the prana, resolves into the mind, resolves into the ananda, or resolves into the self. There's a whole panchakosha viveka, a whole analysis that takes Shwetaketu step by step by step by step to the recognition that I am that Brahman. In a sense, you would think that you would include yourself initially, just by the description of Brahman, because listen to it. In the beginning, all there was one non-dual being. Now, do you have being? Yes. Okay. But we don't think like that. In the beginning, all there was one non-dual being. That means there's nothing else but that being. Right there, as soon as you say that, you either are that being, or you're not here. Right? Because there's only one non-dual being. In the beginning, only one non-dual being. That's it. From this one non-dual being, all of this has come. That means all of this must be that one non-dual being, because there is nothing else. It's not like there was one non-dual being and over here there was a bunch of, you know, wooden nails or whatever, right? There's just one non-dual being, and from the one non-dual being, all of this has come. And so, you must be that. But when you first hear it, Brahman in the beginning was just one non-dual being with nothing else was there. Isn't that interesting? You know, that Brahman could be one non-dual being and I'm still over here. I don't realize what non-dual means. Non-dual means there is nothing else. There is no over here. There's just being, period. And so when this being comes, when the creation comes from this being, that's what we call Maya. That's why we say this creation is Maya, because there's no room for anything else. If there's only one non-dual being and that's all there is, there's no space for anything else. So that's what they say with Maya. That's why they bring in, or the Upanishad brings in Maya, to make you understand that this creation of infinite manifest name and form, right, has no being of its own other than that one non-dual being. But now the question is, okay, from this one non-dual being the creation comes, is sustained and resolves. Who are you? Who are you? Where do you fit into this? You can't be outside of it. You could say, what could you say? You'll start out just starting with this physical body. I am this physical body sustained by food. Yeah. But then what sustains the physical body? So there's a whole movement, panchakosha viveka. What do we mean by the panchakosha? It's like the body is one kosha. The prana, the vital force, is another. The manomaya kosha is another, the mind. The vijnanamaya kosha, the intellect, the buddhi, the ahankara, is another. The Anandamaya Kosha is another. So slowly, slowly he had to work through these upadis to recognize that the self of the upadi. And the self of the upadi becomes recognized as what? The one non-dual being from which all has come. And so I'm telling it quickly, but there's actually many verses in that teaching that take where Shvetaketu's father takes him step by step by step through this Panchakosha Viveka to the recognition Tetvamasi, you are that. So it starts out with a recognition of Brahman as being the one non-dual being, which should be aparoksha, really, when you really think about it. But there's a distance to travel. A distance to travel that doesn't involve distance. Between there was one non-dual Brahman to I am that. In the beginning there was one non-dual Brahman, which is the self of all of us, to I am that Brahman. That there's a distance to travel. Even though there's no distance to travel. Right? So here, he says, initially, he says, grahito, having known prokshataha indirectly, the brahma-sattvam, the being, the existence of Brahman, by this vakya, sadeva, samya, idam, ugra, asit, by this vakya, having known the nature of Brahman, it's only when he works through the tattvamasi, you are that Brahman, that he recognizes what the actual nature of Brahman is. It's really incredible. Think of it like this. The universe is. That isness is Brahman. And you can say, the whole universe is. But you have to recognize that the word isness that makes it paroksha, the word isness makes it paroksha. You have to recognize that that experience of isness is the experience of amness. That amness is isness. There is no such thing in your repertoire of experience. There is no objectification of isness. You can't look at isness. The only reason you know isness is because you are that. Right? So instead of using isness, the only reason you know being is because you are being. So now, if you think of it in just in terms of the dual language that we experience, the only reason you know isness is because you are isness. But we call it amness. So amness and isness are one and the same thing. So that's going from the paroksha of it is to the aparoksha of I am. The it is resolves into the I am. Right? And it's that resolution of isness into amness that makes me realize that this whole creation is enjoying my amness. There's not isness and amness. This creation is enjoying my amness, the amness that I am. You see what I'm saying? It's an important little shift that we have to make there. Okay. And that recognition, going from the isness, Brahman is, to the I am that. That is the vyakti. When we say vyakti, it's no longer general. You now have recognized what Brahman is. You've recognized it as your own being. And so now you have direct aparoksha jnanam of what was always there. You have your mind has aparoksha jnanam of what has always been there, self-evident aparoksha, by its own swarupa. Now the mind has aparoksha jnanam, direct immediate knowledge of what has always been direct and immediate. But because of ignorance, has been taken to be paroksha, but there is no paroksha. See, there is no such thing as paroksha in reference to the self. There is no paroksha. There is no indirect self. There's no self that's aware. There's only aparoksha. There's only direct immediate, the direct immediate experience of the self. But it's the mind that has this paroksha, aparoksha. Right? Because the mind takes what is aparoksha to be paroksha. As the amness that I am, it recognizes it as belonging to the body, not as the amness that belongs to the creation. Yeah, I think that's enough. Yeah, let's take a minute.
Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
To understand where it is that the mind, which has to have its doubts all taken care of, is the doubts happen in relation to ananda, which would be I am whole, unified, nothing's missing, where it forgets or where it's not convinced, when there's something appears that in all of this, you know, creation, that this is not me, and so then I would desire something or fear it.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of the areas. In fact, we call that, in reference to ananda, I mean, of course, what everybody is seeking is to feel happy and whole and complete, and we've spent beginningless lifetimes believing that that happiness was something out here that we could satisfy. And then when you realize that's not true, your mind still has all kinds of, yeah, but I still want this. I know intellectually it's not true, but I still need this to be happy, and I still need this. So that's one area where I have to keep bringing my mind back to myself. You know, and that's where karma yoga, this karma yoga buddhi, all of this comes in. It becomes very important because I have to give my mind a chance to kind of unwind. But so, yeah, that's one area, just in just the idea of, am I really the source of happiness? Am I really the source of even happy vrittis in the mind? How do those take place? So I have to understand all of that. So all those doubts have to be cleared, but there's all different areas where doubts have to be cleared, like, how can I say I am this? That just like the clay is the self of the pot, or the water is the self of the ocean, how can I say I, this conscious being that I am the very self of this whole creation? Because I see material, you know? So I have to then be able to see that actually there is no material here. There is no matter. There's only consciousness. You try to find, there's consciousness, there's name and form, and Satchitananda. Satchitananda plus name and form. There's no matter separate from, that doesn't, the matter is consciousness.
But Carol, you know, when we do this, the superimposition of I am the body, you know, that superimposition, then we use drip drisha to undo that, you know, to see, oh, I'm not the body, I'm always here, uh-huh. The body changes, I'm not the body. But then the superimposition of the amness,
uh-huh,
onto the objects as isness, that to me is, I have a hard time with that. I mean, I understand that isness and amness are the same, but it is as if I understand it paroksha. I don't understand how, I mean, because I understand how I can superimpose my amness on the body-mind. I understand how that happens.
Yeah.
But I don't understand how I superimpose, in a sense, my own amness. Not that I take myself to be that bookcase or anything, but I believe you said that we superimpose this business onto objects.
Yeah.
But I don't understand that. Because it seems to me like they are. I mean, they is. You know, so, I mean, Trik
Dusha works...
I mean, Trik Dusha works for separating the amnes from the bottom line. But then, kind
of... Okay, I understand what you're saying. When you... First of all, in just simple experience, all of this world that you're experiencing through your sense organs, you give it existence. Right? You take it totally for granted. This exists, the table exists, the rug exists. We give existence to everything. Absolutely. In this room, that you're everything that you're perceiving through your sense organs, absolutely everything equally enjoys existence. You don't say this has a little less than this. Right? Every single thing that you experience has an equal amount of existence. Right? Now, and existence is not just a hypothetical. Right? I mean, you experience it as existing, as being. But then we say, how do you experience it as being? You experience name and form through your sense organs, but how do you experience the being of it, which is so self-evident? The being of our experience is self-evident, right? Now, where is the being that is, where is this self-evident being that everything equally enjoys? You can say, well, it's in each object. The self-evident being is in each object. Well, do you see it there? Do you see it there? Because it's self-evident, but it's not objectifiable. Do you know what I mean by self-evident? That you totally take it for granted. It is, it is, it is, it is, it is. Everything is pervaded by existence, by being. And so, because everything, absolutely everything is pervaded by being, really just like, you know, like if we use the clay pot, the pot is totally pervaded by clay. It is clay. So here you say, everything is pervaded by being. There is no experience away from being. But where is the being located? It's aparoksha, but it's not objectifiable. What makes it into, like, subject-object is language. Amnes and isness. But there is no amnes and isness experience, as though there's an isness experience different from amnes experience. Mm. There's a different experience in name and form differences. But put this body into the objectified world. Put the sense organs into the objectified world. The mind, the thoughts, into the objectified world. And say they all enjoy isness. But now if you say they all enjoy isness, what is your experience of that isness? It's just language. Your experience of that isness is your own being. And in language we say amness.
But I guess what I don't understand is, like, if that knowledge is aparoksha, the knowledge of the isness is,
Now wait a minute. Yeah. There's two things to understand here. Existence, which is consciousness, is aparoksha. It's self-shining, okay? Your buddhi, your mind, needs to gain aparoksha jnanam of that aparoksha self. But the aparoksha doesn't require, the self-evident nature of the self doesn't require the buddhi. It is self-evident because it itself is conscious being, consciousness being. So it doesn't require anything to make it self-evident. It is self-evident. Now the problem is that the mind, enjoying that self-evident self, takes itself to be that. Right? The mind says, I am the self-evident self. Right? Because the self is self-evident. Now the mind says, I am the self-evident self. And therefore sometimes I'm a crabby self-evident self. Sometimes I'm happy, self-evident self. Sometimes I'm sad, self-evident self. Right? It just identifies, the mind identifies whatever it is with the self-evident self. So that mind needs to gain aparoksha jnanam of the aparoksha self. Now the aparoksha self, the self that you are, the self-evident self, that is the existent being from which the whole universe has come. There is no other existent being. And so now, this manifest universe, the whole thing is nothing but self-evident conscious being.
But real Dhyana Nishtha is you know that you know in aparoksha that all of this creation shares your being.
Is your being. Mm-hmm.
So that you, I mean, because
okay,
I
let me take it one other step.
Okay.
This creation, then you say, well, there's me and there's it.
That's where I feel sort of stuck.
Okay, but now, how do we get rid of there being a this?
The analysis.
Yeah.
But that analysis, which I totally get and accept, but it still doesn't seem to lead to aparoksha jnanam for the object somehow. For the isness of the object.
Yes, it does.
My amness.
It does, because there is no object. That's what if you could find an object away from the subject. Well, first of all, if we say, I am the self of the subject and I am the self of the object, what do I mean by that? It means that this body, mind, sense organs, which plays the role of the subject within duality, say in this room, each one, we've got all of these subjects here, perceiving all of the objects. Okay, we've got all these subjects perceiving all of these objects, right? But really, all of the subjects themselves are perceived, right? Even by the subject. In other words, this body, we say it's a subject, but actually, it's perceived by all of you and it's perceived by me too. So, the subject, what if I say that, so do you see how I can say, I am the self of the subject and the object. I am the self of this body, and I am the self of this body, of the mind, of the sense organs. All of these things, I am the self of that. That makes this an object, like all of these objects. So now, all these objects, including my body, mind, sense organs, enjoy, now there's only objects. And one subject, right? And that one subject is Satchit, Ananda. Now this subject, this Satchit, this existent being, is the being which all objects enjoy. There is no other being for, right? There is no other being. Now say you say, well, yes, there is. There's all these people here, all these things. Find one. There, every single thing in Maya, it's all Mithya. Every single thing in the creation is infinitely divisible. You can never find a thing. Like, we call this a lamp. It's not a lamp. Lamp is a L-A-M-P. It's a word for a conglomerate of all of these things. And you get down to atoms and quarks. You know, this lamp, it's got a pole and a base and a light and a basin for the top, and a switch, and cords running through it. The lamp is just a word, right, for a conglomerate. But what isn't like that? You try to find a thing that's not a conglomerate. There is no thing. There's nothing. But as you're going dissecting, what each time you dissect it into smaller and smaller parts, all of those things exist. You can never get away from the being, but there's no thing. There's only being. There's only consciousness. You know, because you'd go on dissecting, trying to find something, and everything that you find, that thing now is, and it is known. And then you take that apart, and it isn't known. And then you have something coming into being and going out of being. Well, that is known too. It's known before, during, and after. So what's the common denominator? It is known. Well, where does this isness reside? It doesn't reside anywhere. It is the very being from which all things come. But what is yourself? Yourself is that. And that is, you can say, if you don't want to say amness or an isness, just say that is the being which I am.
Well, when you have that recognition, how can you tell whether it's abstract, understanding what you say, or
Because you're not abstract. You don't say, am I abstract? When you're talking about me, just, you know, when you're talking about yourself, am I having an abstract experience? When you say abstract, you mean a concept, right?
Yeah.
Like a theoretical concept. Is my self-experience a theory? It isn't. It's a self-evident baseline experience that you take absolutely for granted. When we're talking, you cannot get more simple. That's part of our problem. Even Swamiji has said before, I laughed, I remember years ago when I was just started studying and I was in India and we were walking, all of us were taking a walk, he wanted to show us this big bonfire. So he took us for this walk and we all sat around this huge bonfire that was blazing. And I said something very profound. Of course, I didn't know it was profound. But nevertheless, I said, this is all really simple, isn't it, Swamiji? And I didn't really know the I mean, if I said that now, I would really know what I meant. I didn't know what I meant at that time. But it just seemed like it's all making sense. It was all seemed so simple. But he said, he laughed, and he said, that is the problem. There's so much unwinding that our mind has to do to be able to recognize the absolute, the obvious. It's a recognition of what's right in front of your face. It's so much in front of your face that the mind is looking every place else. You know, it's so, it is you, the you that you take to be you. And how are you going? Me? You know, I remember the first when I first, you know, kind of understood the shock. I was shocked. Remember, I've told that story before as I was walking around down that path at the ashram. And all of a sudden I realized that I, the one that I take to be myself, that I wasn't moving. Just realized the stillness of myself. And I remember I stopped. And I went, I started going like this. It was ridiculous, you know. But then I was so afraid I wasn't going to, I was going to lose it. You know, I was going to lose it. I was going to, you know. And so I even walked down to the lecture hall. I walked so slowly, you know. And I thought, no, this is really me. This is really me. It's astounding. Because you don't think it's you. I mean, the you that you take to be you, you don't think it's you. It's you. That's what's so incredible. And so once you recognize that, and then there is something, I know why this is difficult, something has to click where you realize that the being that you are giving your being to the universe, there's no objectification of your self-experience, the being. And there's nothing here that can have it because nothing here has any being. And when you go to analyze it, you can't find a thing here. It's impossible.
But when we say it doesn't have any being, while we're analyzing it, we say all we can find is being.
Yes, but what that means is that being is non-objectifiable. Mm-hmm. What I mean is, like, you say this is a lamp, but
right.
We take it into its components. It's not a lamp.
Right.
This is a conglomerate. There's nothing that's not like that. You can never get to the substance of the form. You'll just get smaller and smaller forms. But those smaller and smaller forms always have being. They always exist. But where's the isness located? It can't be in the form. You have to take the form off. So what's the if you take the form off, you know, so that you can see what the substance is, well, then there's no form. You can't see it. So you are it. So you have to it's something that's even a good meditation to see. See if you can tell the difference even right now between your am-ness and the is-ness that you give to the creation. There aren't two experiences. And the being that you give to the creation is not something you're seeing. You're seeing names and forms. Right? And the being that these names and forms enjoy is absolutely stable. It's absolutely solid. Not solid like a rock, but solid. That there's no motion. It is what is.
So So for all this, like nidhi asana would just be really good. Just sit there and just like watch your thoughts and see they.
And see that the being which those thoughts enjoy is absolutely stable. And then start with your thoughts, and then use your the perceptions of the world and see.
Carol, I want to ask this question about consciousness because I feel like I have my experience of consciousness is always a consciousness of something in particular.
Your experience of consciousness is always something.
Of something in particular, like space or time, you know, always, you know, the time or, you know, cause and effect, I mean, things like that.
Yeah.
So I feel like I don't have an experience of just consciousness in and of itself. Like, it's hard for me to, like, locate the referent for that,
yeah.
You know?
You know what is really, really helpful for that, I think, is japa. Do you know how to do japa?
Yeah,
with the beads. Why that's helpful is because, well, first of all, there's never a thought that's away from consciousness. So that's kind of a given. But it also tells you that consciousness is always there. Right? So now the thing is, can I differentiate clearly the nature of consciousness itself from the thought? So japa is good for that because by the repetition of a mantra, you first of all, you're breaking associative thinking. And by breaking the associative thinking, then you slow down the mind. And what starts happening is that, say, if you're doing a mantra like Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, say you've done that 20 times, then you go Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, and then you have some silence, and Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya. Om Namah Shivaya. What happens is that the mind starts, instead of seeing just first the mantra, then mantra silence, mantra silence, mantra silence, then it starts to recognize, no, there's the silent, changeless backdrop in which the mantra rises and sets. Once that happens, you've differentiated the conscious being from the maya. And then you can recognize what it is in its own right, because you've separated it, right? So that's a good way to start. Yeah.
I've been kind of playing and working with this concept that I read in the book, the woman who had the stroke. And you know, I think I had this concept from before, but somehow it's just like blowing me away with the idea of the retina takes the, you know, the photons of light and translates it into
the brain,
form, you know,
yeah.
And that the, you know, sound waves translate into, you know, vibrations translate into sound, but then, and I go, oh, that explains it, that's it, and then, but then I go, but how does this have solidness, you know? How does that come to me, that's solid when it actually isn't, you know? Does that make sense?
Well, if you were to, say, analyze this, I mean, it has a certain density in relationship to other things, but if you were to, say, analyze it, shave off a piece and put it under a microscope, you'd see that it also has a tremendous amount of space, just like everything that we see that looks solid, we know through science, right? And through putting a microscope to it, that actually there's much more space here than what we see. But you experience it as dense. But that doesn't mean that it's solid. Another way to think of it, like say in a dream, there are things which are solid. In fact, in the Mandukya Upanishad, they use this example, the person is sitting on a chair and saying, this is real. How can you say this isn't real? It's solid, I can press it, it has weight. How can you say this isn't real when I feel it? I'm hurting myself by pinching. What do you mean? You know? And so within the frame, within the box, there's reality, right? But then when you wake up from the dream, you realize the whole thing is nitya. But I don't think I'm answering your question. Maybe I didn't quite understand it.
Well, I think you're answering my question. I think that it's a different, it's just a different thing, that the vision, that's the hearing and the touch. They're different.
Yeah, they're different sense organs.
And they have different
spheres.
Yeah.
Like the eyes have the sphere of color, right? We say color instead of form, really, because your hands can feel the form. So we'll usually say the eyes have color, that their sphere. The nose has the sense of smell, mouth sense of taste, like that.
Just seems like the eyes and the ears are more in just operating on translating vibration.
I don't know if you can. I don't know. Maybe. Well, you're seeing it because they travel distance, right? Sound mm-hmm. travels from here, mm-hmm. where the sense of taste is more localized, the sense of touch is more localized, the sense of smell isn't.
But it's still just translating neurological impulses anyway.
Yeah, no matter what it is.
No matter what.
No matter what its source is, it's still impulses.
Plugging into the appropriate organ.
Yeah, that's right. What might help, though, my mind is brain dead, so I can't do it for you tonight, but... You know, when we look at the Maya, the creation, as it projects as space, air, fire, water, earth, space is more subtle than air, than fire, than water, than earth. There's levels of subtlety. But each one of those elements has a sattva, rajas, and tamas component. And so when you watch how the Vedanta, how it does what the Panchikarana. Panchikarana means making fivefold, how it accounts for the manifestation of this creation. It's really beautiful. And you would understand, the sense of hearing being a product of space is much more subtle than a little less subtle, you know, is the sense of touch, a little less subtle is the sense of sight. There's just different ways that it works. You can work with it. It becomes... Nice. Yeah, it's a very beautiful model. It's a descriptive model. It's a model that's used to make you recognize this creation as the manifestation of one thing. That's what the model, so if you think model, is this a scientific model? It's not a scientific model, it's a descriptive model that accounts for everything that exists within the creation, including the jiva, the individual with sense organs and mind and all of the things that we perceive and the relationship between the perceiver and the perceived and the relationship of that with all of the elements. So.
Sometimes I think about this, I don't know if this is like really crazy to think about or not, but like how, you know, as human beings we pretty much see things the same way, you know, we function the same way.
Yeah.
But I still remember seeing these shows about like horseshoe crabs who see like six different things when we see one. They see that same one thing as six different things. So sometimes they think, well, who knows what's really here? You know, in a way?
Yeah, well, who knows what's really here? Yeah. But we are designed to see it in this particular way.
Yeah,
but we do know that in terms of what's really here is that it exists within time and space,
yeah,
conceptually, and that it comes and goes. So it doesn't really matter. We're programmed to see it all in a certain way. But whatever way we're seeing it, we can come to certain conclusions. You know? I'm done.
Stay with it for like 2 days.
Yeah.
No.